Question one. What secret in Sixth Miss report would be worth killing him for? Question two. Is it reasonable to believe that they would kill again to protect that secret? And if so, question three. What the f*** am I doing here?
Where's our money?
This is FilmSack. Oh, sure.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 430 of FilmSack, mining the very depths of film entertainment for all mankind for nearly 10 years. That's right. October, baby. This is episode 430. I'm Scott Johnson. Joining me today, Brian, the true Dunaway.
Oh, true. Oh, hi.
Hello.
Question one. What secret in the Wachowskis' 2012 movie adapted from a book would be worth killing 3 hours for? Question two. Is it reasonable to believe that this movie would not require me to turn on closed caption on Netflix to unlock that secret? A secret that is perhaps hidden in the true language? Maybe so, maybe no. And if so, question three. What in the name of old Georgie himself am I doing here? Uh-oh. Hold on a second, guys. Who comes a-rapping at my high-rise apartment chamber door? Oh, hi. Hey, guys. I gotta go. It's the Wachowskis. They're banging trays, and I do believe they intend to throw me off the balcony for what I done said about their movies over the years. I gotta go. Speed Racer sucked!
I mean, you're not wrong about that.
True.
True there. Also with us, Randy, anyone else get a hardcore Sense 8 vibe, Jordan?
Ooh. Aloha, Scott. Brian.
Hi.
Randy.
Did I ever tell you boys about the time I proved that nothing is impossible?
No.
True story. This life is nothing short of a deepening vision of a sublime stardust. Soon, there will be an evolving purpose the likes of which the infinite has never seen. We can no longer afford to live with dogma. Selfishness is the antithesis of transcendence. You may be ruled by bondage without realizing it. Do not let it disrupt the healing of your story. We are at a crossroads of synchronicity and delusion. Our conversations with other adventurers have led to a flowering of super powerful consciousness throughout history. Humans have been interacting with the quantum matrix via chaos-driven reactions. Old white man should never wear prosthetics to look like another race. That's some ugly shit.
There's a lot of that going on.
So much rubber in this film.
Yeah, a lot of rubber.
Lots of latex.
Also, finally, Brian, welcome to Neo Soul Ibit.
Kids, you want the yarn of my life years? I'll give you the true. Before the fall, 106 winters ago in 1980, me and my chum Henry were scavenging in a dwell just for the women kind. Did that hinder some Henry and me? Sure as old Georgie, nay. We garb dressed to appear just like the women kind so as we could scavy among them. Later, in one of my other life years, I was a ranch minder playing doll, far, far with a presh famkind babbit named Andy. Andy also box-nabbed a playing doll named Buzz Lightyear, who liked to yibber about the space. Ah, yay, kids. Me and playing doll Buzz sure enjoy some of the adventures which are with our playing doll friend kind. All right, scoot foot for sup now, and when you're older, I'll yarn you the true about my bachelor party and my playing doll Tawny Katane. Now get!
get now!
Wow, that, you know, that was really authentic what you did there.
That was really good.
I found stuff from the book. Like there was a there's a website that's actually got like a translator.
True language?
Right. The true language. It only lists like about 14 things, so I made a bunch of other things like playing doll, ranch minder, fan kind.
It's right. Pretty good. Which also tells me that it's
I'll write the sequel.
Yeah,
it's one of the most
iCloud Atlas. Yeah, right.
One of the most lingering things from this movie, if you haven't seen it, we're talking about Cloud Atlas from 2012. Based on the book, if you haven't seen it, one of the things that we have the luxury of here on FilmSack, we've all seen it, so we know what the true language is. However, if you are going into this movie for the first time, never read the book, oh my God. If I was at the theater, I would have been throwing my popcorn at Tom Hanks right off the bat going, I can't understand you.
Yeah, but that whole segment or that whole storyline, I feel like works on a level where you almost don't need the language. Everything is so well done in context and like the, you know, witnessing the slaying of his family and then going and finding the, you know, the temple and then coming back and kind of, you know, doing the whole thing. Yeah. Feel like that's the only one of the stories that could work that way.
Right. Well, I think as a film, that was my first stumbling block. So if you hear me talking about it throughout this episode, I had the same trouble when they introduced me to V for Vendetta. Whenever you have a language, because I'm really ignorant I'm really ignorant when it comes to audio learning. I'm really good at reading and learning, but when it comes to language, if it's outside of my norm, this is my own limitations, nobody's fault, just my limitations, I get very hung up on trying to figure out what they are saying, and I can't see anything. I just become blind to everything.
I think there's something to that. I think it's a lot easier to read a language and learn it than it is to
because you can see root words.
Just
easily.
Pick it up in context, right? Because you're focused on you're focused on the sounds and you're not picking up on the repetition and like, oh, he just used that phrase again or that word again and that means this.
Yeah.
But when you read it, boom, man, it's easy, much easier.
There's probably
reason why it works in a book, and then that's the trouble of translating a book to film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the book. Has everyone read the book or no?
I have not read the book.
I haven't either, and I've always heard this is a book you should read. It's so great, so great, and so great. Anyway, I've never done it. Here's the thing, or here's my question: why did I like this movie? I was told it was terrible. I was told I was going to hate this, that it was going to be awful, and I liked it.
Was this your first watching of it?
Yes.
Okay, here's the funny thing. I was about to say, I did not like if you would have asked me to rate this movie before I saw it, I would have said a 4. Mm-hmm. This viewing moved it up to like a 7 or an 8 for me. I actually really enjoyed it the second time. And I think it's because, number one, just like Brian said, you don't have to focus on trying to understand the language of the old men or whatever, you know, the Kona, or not the Kona, Kona's the bad guys, but the old Hawaii people.
Right.
The
old Hawaii people.
Second, I think you know there's that disorientation of seeing it the first time and not immediately knowing that it's going to be different time periods, and you're like, wait, all right, so is that Tom Hanks? So he was a gangster and then he became an old dude at the fire.
That was probably my biggest complaint about the movie. And like, I really like, for people who haven't seen it and actually sat and watched the whole thing just for FilmSack, I really want to apologize. It's like such a, I can't remember the last time we watched a movie and I came along feeling like, man, there's strangers out there who are probably hating us right now.
But I should be one of those strangers, and I really liked it. And I don't know why I liked it. I mean, part of it is, I assume the book doesn't say, this character looks like the other dude from another time. Like this movie just decides to dive into that weird conceit.
Well, like I'm saying, that's the thing I hate the most about the film. Like I think it could have been a much, much better film if they had found a way to thread these things all together without using the same faces or the same eyes in a lot of places. Like Hugo Weaving's eyes are like, you can see right through whatever makeup he's wearing, you know, like it bugged me.
Even the one where they changed his eyes, you could still see him like, oh my gosh.
And Hugo Weaving. I love Keith David, but him being in multiple different time frames, my brain is constantly going, okay, how is this the same person? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, it's not the same person. You're not supposed to get that. Well, then they shouldn't have used the same actors. But anyway, the thing I love the most about the film is the fact that these actors, when they all have like a good thing. Like every one of them is in a spot at some point in the movie where you're like, oh, that's the real story of that person, so to speak. You know, like that's the good one.
Yeah.
Like for Ben Whishaw, it's the thing where he is like a genius young composer who ends up, you know, falling in with a horrible old man who's England's greatest composer. I thought that was really interesting, that that whole idea. And then you know, like, so they have we keep returning to, you know, this Ben Whishaw's character, you know, dealing with this dumb old man and kind of falling for him a little bit, you know, and then ultimately killing him. And
well, sometimes you slay the dragon, and sometimes the dragon slays you.
Yeah.
But it's like that. Take that all and put it all together, and it's a beautiful little story. It's very well shot, very well acted, and then it gets chopped up into pieces and spread out all over this movie. And I'm like, ah, screw it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the problem with this movie. Okay, first of all, let me say, love the movie. Also, hate the fact that the movie was limited by is medium, the format of trying to keep within a double length feature film a story that really needs to sprawl a lot larger.
HBO miniseries or regular series, that's what this needs to be. 100%.
It needs this audience an opportunity to learn the language before being thrown into this. However, that being said, this is probably the best you could expect in an exceptional job in the format that was given for this source material.
Imagine for a moment that this was six different miniseries, like a series of series, all strung together.
Love it.
And you watched the entire thing with you know, with each story in its time frame over five episodes. And then you took a breath. And then now you're watching the next one and you're seeing the same actors. They're playing different characters, but you're not seeing them back to back in different time frames. I think it could have been beautiful.
That's kind of what they do with American Horror Story, right? I mean, it's the same group of actors playing different characters, but not in a jumbled story like this, but just season to season.
So here's my crazy thought. Imagine taking Waiting for Guffman and Best in Show and For Your Consideration and like imagine taking all of those films and chopping them into pieces and mixing them together and watching them all at the same time.
This movie is essentially an exploration in genres.
The big difference of that though is that all those movies, Best in Show and For Your Consideration and Guffman and all that, all take place during the same time period. Yep. This one, the only way you could do it and make it work, like Cloud Atlas attempts, is to have everything take place where the surroundings are different enough that you don't have to rely on the character cues to figure out which storyline you're watching. Like, okay, we're in the jungle. It's the Hawaii story, or we're in future Seoul, New Seoul. And
The main thing, my mind immediately goes, this may be my limitation as a viewer. My mind immediately wants to find pattern, and it needs that thread to go through all of the stories, but it needs that thread to be obvious. It would be like trying to unwrap a bunch of wires. And if you don't know where to start, it's gonna be very difficult. The thread here, eventually I found it. It was all the way at the end, but it was the continuation of stories. So each story was retold to each character, and that's how they were all tied in. And what I observed was like, okay, in the very beginning, the lawyer was keeping his journals, and then that was passed on to the next character.
It was read by the composer dude.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then the composer dude created the Cloud Atlas suite.
Yeah.
Did that, and also had love letters that eventually found its way into our our third story. And then the third story was actually written. It was called Half-Life, I believe it was what it was called, or something similar to that, of Halle Berry's character and so forth.
And it goes to the publisher, and the publisher story is actually a really good standalone story.
Yeah, it's very good.
That's the main Jim Broadbent performance, although he's all over this movie.
He's great. My gosh, he's good. He's so good.
He is really good.
But him as a publisher, and it, like, it's almost his main story is almost about everything around him more than him, right? Like the author that throws some critic off of a balcony at the beginning of that story. It's like, wow, that is so awesome and interesting. And like, he ends up, you know, trapped in a retirement home, and it's a little bit overly comedic, but, you know, like, it's such a good story that you don't really even realize that he's a publisher. So he got a manuscript from whatever, you know, 1970s. You know what I'm saying?
Written by Halle Berry's younger neighbor friend.
Yeah, his name was on the paper. I remember the camera lingering there, and I went, I'm supposed to remember that.
Okay. I didn't catch that either. Yeah. Boy, so, I need to watch the third damn time.
Yeah.
But yes. The thing is, you don't. Like, the movie should have stood on for itself. Like, it should have gotten this all through to you. And it doesn't, because it's so mixed up and it's trying so hard to confuse you, you know?
There was some of that, but I wanna say there's a place in this world. I'm not sure this movie achieves it or not, but there's a place in this world for movies that are full of symbols and hints and stuff that you didn't notice the first time through, because the ending then informs you wanting to see it again and then find those details. I think there's room for that.
Yeah.
I think three in hours and 12 minutes, or whatever the hell it is. What is it? Whatever it is.
Slightly under 3 hours.
It's a lot.
Something like that.
It's a lot. Right. But I had this one weird feeling through
and
the whole thing.
Enough.
It reminded me of Fargo somehow. And I mean the television show, also the movie, but Fargo, at the way that they have their connected universe. This one's set in 2003. This one's in 1978. Yes. This season's set in whatever.
And it's connected without, like, really obvious, super easy to see connective tissue. It's like, oh, okay, that guy put the money in that briefcase and buried it under the snow, and then this guy found it. That's really the only connection you have between.
Yeah, I kept Fargo's. since we're using the same actors to play different characters in different roles in each of the time periods, I was really holding on as a viewer to the fact that they were connected linear in that way, but it wasn't that in the end. At the end, it was like, oh, each of these characters plays a different role in each time period. And so I was really trying to hold on.
He was always a dick.
Yeah.
Right. Well, he was one of the consistents. He was the true,
he wasn't in all of them.
He was. He was all the way to the, even in the first one, he was the stepdad. Or I'm sorry, he was the dad.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he was always bad, wasn't he?
He was always in there, and he was always bad.
Yeah. Or always ominous, or at the very least ominous and weird, like the freaking Mad Hatter goblin guy.
He was the cog of tribalism and racism and just a constant whispering. Literal whispering in the last story of trying to separate people and to keep them apart.
Yeah, he's a huge dick in that scene.
Yeah, he's a huge giant dick.
he's also you know, he's the Wachowski regular here, which I always like. He's kind of consistent in all their movies. I sort of get giddy when I see him. I really like him. Chews up the scenery. He's just very interesting. But I want to say, I feel kind of across the board, the whole cast is awesome, but in particular,
amazing cast.
Yeah. In particular, I think the acting chops, like, I think, there's so many places my brain wants to go. All right. Let me say this first. The Tom Hanks, old guy
thread.
Hawaii. Yeah. The Hawaii bit. Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Is fascinating, because to me, that's one of the most interesting stories, and there's so much about that world building we don't get told that I have all made up in my head. For example, it appears to me like a complete flip of society. White people are not enslaved, like, so not completely flipped with, like, the 1700s
societal
or something,
separation,
but
still tribal,
yeah,
right?
Very tribal, but the white people are all living hand to foot and raising sheep and, you know, just scraping to stay alive. And that includes the sort of evil marauding, whatever the hell they were.
The Kona.
They're as white as you get too. And but everybody who seems to have figured it out and has all the civilization and the civility all appear to be people of color. And I thought that was really interesting, and I wanted to know more about that. Like, how did that end up getting there?
I hated that segment. Of the six of them, that was thing I hated so much. Like, I
didn't hate it at all.
There were times I was like skipping forward. Like, I'm not even going to watch. If they can't go film this actually in Hawaii instead of if they can't have anybody who is even a little bit Hawaiian, like, I'm just like, no.
Yeah, but your future multi apocalypse later kind of time. Like, this isn't that's my point, is so much of that world building is left out that you have to, your brain has to try to assemble it, because this is like after Korean
106
lady.
106 winners after.
Yeah, the
that's okay then. Mm-hmm. That's just an excuse for whitewashing things, like having white people playing Koreans. Funny.
Wow, you
can't. I was gonna say, man, the whitewashing, if it only extends to the non-Hawaiians playing Hawaiians, right, it doesn't extend
that's
to the
pretty
non-Koreans.
That is very particular. Yeah, this is a pretty inclusive movie, with some exception, of course. But
it's not at all. Like, the author David Mitchell obviously didn't know anything about the world outside of England, like, you know what I mean? Like,
I mean, maybe, like, but I don't see, again, I haven't read the book, so I can't say. I think that's really interesting to say everybody on this island and this weird sub English language and all of it, these are Caucasian people doing that. That's not normally what you see. That's in the face of normalcy.
Western filmmaking.
Yeah, right. That's flipped completely. Our brains would settle in and go, oh, well, these, if they were all Polynesian, look at me. Oh, of course, they're in Hawaii. But this is like so far flung in the future. So much has happened. You've got the societal divide, and they don't explain it, but I was fascinated by that. I wanted to know more about it. I like the idea that you just flipped it all on its head. And, make the...
End of the day, it's about this. This movie's about tribalism more than anything. And, you know, and your roles in the current society, whatever they be, and that those roles flip constantly, and how those characters would respond being in a new situation. So it was interesting to see that. I actually like the Zachary storyline the best, because that's the only time that the Tom Hanks character actually gets a chance to grow. Otherwise, he's a very two-dimensional character.
It's also where he's the best in the movie. He's not great in all the other Tom Hanks bits. Although, I think the one where he's poisoning the dude on the ship, that's pretty good. The
doctor. Dr. Henry Goose.
But the mobster,
that's my favorite. Dermot Hoggins.
Dermot Hoggins, yeah.
They're going to give you some punches.
that one I could have skipped. The Tom Hanks. They could have left.
No, you could have skipped the Tom Hanks. I don't know, but him coming up and going, you know, tequila, two fingers, and he just, you know, and
throwing that guy
off. By the way, I hate all the secret keeping that they were doing in this film. Fine, keep your secrets, Wachowskis. But some of it was enjoyable. Like, I enjoyed the fact that the critical, the guy that was doing the reviews for Dermot Hoggins, that got thrown off the roof, was the musician in the 70s that was with Halle Berry in his loft up there. And she said that she wanted to throw him from the balcony, and she did not. Mm-hmm. But he is the actor who later was thrown.
Oh, they do that all the time, the balcony, constantly through the movie. And I understand why they did it
so many times.
That's the same dude, by the way, that was the, the lover that shows up at the end and then becomes the old guy that gets shot in the head by what's his name in this hotel room, makes it look like a suicide. Same guy. But he's also the same guy that's Darcy. The like bald interrogator guy who's interrogating Lee Ming or whatever her name is.
What's the most disturbed that you were of any of the portrayals? The one for me had to be when Halle Berry was in the future as that Marin. She was the Ovid or whatever it was. The Ovid. It was the
doctor thing that was taking the clamp off.
Yeah, the doctor thing with the weird Fu Manchu thing going on. That was just that was disturbing.
Yeah. If you didn't watch the credits, the credits are important to watch. The very first credits, because they flash all the characters that the main actors played.
Oh, really? Oh, I stopped before that. I need to go back.
Don't skip Netflix. That is a must, because there's two or three of those where I went, what? Oh. Are you kidding me? Huh. Like, I could not believe it.
I thought Doona Bay as the, the Korean replicant girl as the...
Sunmi.
As the as the American daughter of Hugo Weaving running off with...
Yeah.
Tilda. Yeah, that was kind of... It was odd to see some faces made up as
well, and sometimes you just didn't know. Do you guys remember there was the thing where she was learning and she was looking at her little oval floating screens, and one of them was like this professor guy doing chalk work?
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's freaking that Susan Sarandon's is that dude.
Oh really?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay, I didn't pick up on that one.
So that's that kind of and I didn't know either until the credits rolled, and I was like,
Yes, I do need to go back and watch. I can hit play right from where I left off.
It's reminding me of what people often say about the video game EVE Online. Mm. It's a great thing if you like to manage spreadsheets, but it's not like it's not the video game that you expect a video game to be.
Right.
And this movie is like that. It's like if you're really interested in a matrix of characters and figuring out who's like, ooh, this is weird. This is weird makeup. This looks like an Englishman pretending to be Korean. Who is that? Oh my God, it's Jim Sturgis. Whoa. Mm. Like, if you're interested in that, great movie. But it's not a movie. It's not a movie the way EVE Online isn't a video game. It's something else, you know?
Well, it's art. It's a lot it like really the, I mean, you could even go back to when Shakespeare was doing plays in the West End, and he'd basically have the same troupe of actors playing the same role, sometimes women, sometimes probably different cultures or different, you know. It's,
I mean, he didn't really have a choice. I think in 2012 we had choices.
And that's
the thing. I come down to liking the things that are native to the people making it, the author and the directors. The three segments that take place in England and San Francisco feel to me like they're the most competent and the most relatable. And it's the segments outside of that where I'm just like, okay, I saw Amistad, and this whole thing on the ship, the boat is like, it just feels like they don't know what they're doing, you know?
Right.
And that's just,
I guess this, I'm glad we were limited, with Keith David, because I loved every time he was on the screen.
He's awesome.
David, always such a joy to watch.
Yeah, except talk. What I mean by that is he's a really...
I understood him way better than Tom Hanks.
Well, no, it's not that. It's that he is one of the most unique voices in all VO narration. He narrates like, I don't know, at least 50% of... what's his name's documentaries? I can't think of his name.
Ken Burns.
Ken Burns documentaries. An amazing, amazing voice. There's nobody quite like it, actually. It's just kind of shocking. And you hear
it
in video games
all the
time.
Every time I see him on screen, there's a little smile that comes over my
face.
Yeah,
but it just, it sounds immediately like...
I've loved him
ever
since They Live.
Yeah,
but
listen, he ends up sounding like every general he's ever played in like a Halo game. Like, it's just impossible to tear him out of that. So when I hear him talk, I'm like, I probably have to get to my next objective. Oh no, I'm just watching a movie.
Can we talk about the worst plan in the movie? Let's see. How about Keith David's character? He says, "Hey, one of Halle Berry's character. Why don't she walk down the street and see if we can pull out a Hugo Weaving to come out and try to run her over? And then I'm gonna T-bone."
Worst plan in the movie is you are a much hated critic, and you confront somebody who looks very strong and hates you in front of a balcony. That's the worst plan.
Yeah. Talking smack still.
Yeah, don't do that by a balcony. Although, that seemed like capital murder in front of everyone.
I know. There were so many things in this film where I'm like, where's the police? How does this movie not have police?
Of course, the
movie has police when a semi-robot. Is she a robot prostitute server in a restaurant? I don't know.
Right.
I don't know what I could never figure out those women were. But there's definitely police in Seoul in 100 years. But they're chasing.
They're
a robot. I don't know. Right. But anyway, like the rest of the movie, I'm just like, San Francisco, 1973. You're telling me there's no police anywhere? Are you kidding?
Yeah, it seems like that. They were pretty devoid of that. That factor. It made it feel a little otherworldly to me, which is why I think I like the future segments maybe more than the more modern day ones. Sure, that stuff's more relatable because, you know, we live in that world, but the stuff that was more sci-fi and crazy, I like the most because the rules have changed and you don't have to think about those things. Like, I don't have to think about that weird restaurant or why it's okay that they make replicants. I mean, it was basically kind of a Blade Runner mini story, that whole bit.
I bet it was fun making this movie because it's almost an anthology of different movie genres, like, you know, all just thrown in a bowl and tossed up good for you. There you go.
Yeah. But also, story. If I had any real complaint, and I don't know how the book handles this, but it didn't seem like the people really had anything to do with each other. Like, in the end of the day.
Well, they didn't, but it would be kind of like that's what was kind of confusing me, because I expect, like I said, I kept expecting the characters to be linear.
Okay. So individual, like all the Tom Hanks characters.
Right. Like reincarnation is what I was assuming. I was like, okay, Tom Hanks is still Tom Hanks. He's still the spirit of Tom Hanks in every time period. Shouldn't he be showing an overall arc of story for his character? But it really didn't play out that way, because they were weaving in and out of weaving in and out of roles in each of their periods and how they would do it. And that kind of threw me off for a little while. But when I eventually was able to put that behind me and go, okay, Brian.
Well, what were the tattoos? They never, is that the chick in the bucket? Because the tattoos. Oh,
no, the chicken, that's not a chick in the bucket. You're talking about the shooting stars?
Birthmark? I keep saying, birthmark's what I meant.
Yeah, the birthmark. That's the driving force. That's the energy that starts from the first story to the last. And it's kind of like the central piece of each period. That's the person who's kind of been tagged to inspire change or to create change and change our story path.
Wait, so the people with the tattoo in each of the segments were like the chief operator of that segment.
Right. And then that was recorded either by themselves or by someone else. And then that was passed on to the next person who was inspired.
Oh, the birthmark. You're talking about the birthmark.
Right, the birthmark. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not the tattoo, yes. Crazy tattoo from Tom Hanks's fist.
No, not that. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Well, that actually helps me a little bit, because to me, every time they showed the birthmark, I was like, well, so y'all have the same birthmark? Is that it? And is that all we're going to say about that? Because it felt very chick in the bucket to me.
Yeah. And so it's actually the opposite of the person carrying through the timelines, because that birthmark jumps from person to person across the six different people.
Right. Right.
Like it's never on the same person in a different timeline.
Right.
And it's kind of like that Lost effect where the reason why I call it Lost effect is because Lost really points it out. Eventually there's a whole character in Lost where he points out that only the central characters ever do anything. And there's at least 50 more people there that never even really get explored unless they're going to show up and die.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So that's kind of what this is. Yeah. There's a central set of characters that kind of flows through.
Well, I thought about Lost a couple times watching this, because there is a similarity in the storytelling style of jumping back and forth between flashbacks and flash forwards and current time and stuff like that. That I think is kind of a really cool storytelling method. It's mm-hmm. compelling to me mm. once you get past the confusion of it. you know, it's just kind of a clever thing. It's like, oh, okay, they're kind of giving me this piece of the story that took place way back in the past when it's the most relevant to the current time frame.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that method, especially when it's done in reverse and you get it kind of flash forward too.
Right. And it was interesting the way they did cut it together. They cut it together with scenes from each time period with the emotion or the energy level. So like all the action pretty much happened in all the stories at the same time.
At the same time, yeah.
During the movie. So the emotional thread they were pulling us along with was consistent. So I thought that was really interesting.
That was pretty cool. And I also liked how a lot of the narration, because different narrators would sort of take over at different times.
Right, right.
And how those
real
would...
difficult thing they did here.
Those would, you know, overlap with the other timelines and then have their connections and their similarities and stuff. And I thought that worked really well. I guess I'm just still sort of shocked how much I liked it. I was going into this and I thought everybody back in 2012, everyone told me to avoid this movie like the giant turd it was. And it was not any good at all. And I was so sad because I was like, Wachowskis, you've fallen so far. But I really liked it.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask Brian Dunaway to rephrase what he just said. This movie is not a lot of fun. Like, it's objectively not a lot of fun. Like, there's got to be a better word for like the theme of the film, like the thing you are supposed to ponder in every time frame, is slaves who are happy being slaves. Like early on in the film, they literally trot a slave into a dining room and ask him, you know, like, are you satisfied with your place in the world? And then you find through every timeline there is someone who is, you know, indentured somehow, mm-hmm. who is being depicted as okay.
Right. And that's what they talked about throughout. It's like, why? And that's one of the things they tell at the dinner conversation very early on in the movie. Why would someone accept their place or role, slave, you know, whatever level they were, why would they accept that role? And so that was something that was all the way through. And every time there was generally something that would create a change of role that was going to be initiated in between the stories.
Yeah, that wasn't, so, I don't think the movie was ever saying, hey, Keith David, do you like being a slave and serving our house or whatever? And he said, yes, sir, really. I sure love it.
Right.
That was supposed to be him saying, no, of course not. Of course I don't, but I have to say I do.
Well, what else can I say, right? Yes. You want the truth. Yeah. The truth is what was really important in the fact that the tribes were lying to each other so often, whether because they had to or because they were looking for, truth was very important as well in this film. And so, yeah, Keith David had to say it because even though it wasn't true, what choice did he have?
Well, right. He didn't have a lot of choice, but then also that was the storyline where we lead to dude becoming woke and quitting and taking his wife to go work on, you know, let's stop slavery.
I love the scene where they're all outside and they're watching, you know, the slaves work in the field. And they say, oh, it's so, he says, you know, it's so hot out here. And they said, oh, it's because civilized folk, you can't handle the heat or something like that. I'm like, you morons, look at the slaves are all walking around with no shirts on like normal humans would do if it was hot. And you're in this three-piece cotton wool thing. Of course you're hot, you moron.
I had no sympathy for dude in the thickest black coat you could wear in the hottest
sweating,
weather possible.
So much sweating.
It's like, come on, dude. Freaking put on a t-shirt. Get some cargo shorts and a pair of sandals. What are you doing? But that was the whole thing, right? If you were more civilized, that meant, the way you dress and you're fully to the nines all the time.
You were a slave to societal expectations, and that's why you were sweating, civilized human, because you have accepted these things, and you're a slave to consumerism, and that was also something that was explored. And also the other language that gave me trouble, you know, in the naming conventions of things, but I eventually got there.
Like what? Like
just the reference in the naming of you know, the languages in the consumer Somni era.
Yeah,
New Soul. They would reference certain peoples or certain ideologies in a way that I'm like, okay, I kind of understand what you're trying to go for, but I don't understand the root words you're looking at there. I'm not sure exactly.
Well, that's where the world building and your imagination kicked in the movie. All those scenes were places where I think I thrive because I like that. I like a movie. Sorry to ad nauseum this, but you know why I like Mad Max Fury Road so much is they don't go out of their way to explain every social construct, every political thing, where life has gone and what happened in the intervening time. Like, I like to build that in my head, and so for me, those scenes really work for me.
And I do too. I think the difference is, I think some people are visual learners and others, you know, can learn by listening. And I'm a very visual learner. I read, and I know a lot of people are as well. And there's other people who listen really well. And I have trouble understanding the words that they're saying. I'm having trouble understanding the words coming out of your mouth.
Yeah.
And, but if I see the word, I'm like, I'm on it. Mm-hmm. I got this. I've seen lots of words. I'm a big reader.
I've seen words.
I've seen words.
Sure. Words are cool.
But when those words come out of people's mouth, I'm like, what did they just say? Did they say purple people eater? What did he just say?
I really like the dude who killed himself in the tub. I can never remember his name.
Jim Sturgis.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I like that guy a lot, and I like him in lots of things, but what I really like about him is that he was the best thing in the Mary Poppins movie that just came out. He was so good in it. And he's perfect at this kind of fastidious sort of They're concerned looking guy. I don't know. It's hard to explain. He's young and handsome, but also old and strange at the same
old
time.
Soul. Yeah. There you go.
There is a little bit of all these white dudes look the same to me thing. Like Jim Sturgess and Ben Whishaw were, I took a long time to tell them apart, like it, from jumping around all the time. And I'm like, all right, which guy am I seeing here? Is this the, you know, is this the guy who kills himself in the tub? Or the...
I can't figure if that's racism or ageism. Is it because they're both young, possibly? Or
I don't think it's either. I think they just look a lot alike, I think.
They look alike. They sound alike. You know, like, it's just, I don't know. I more than once, I thought, oh, this movie could have been better cast. And I actually wrote this thing down, and it's like, I hate to even say it out loud because somebody's going to disagree with me tremendously, but like in a movie where you have these great actors, Halle Berry's a legitimately great actor, and Jim Broadbent is a legitimately great actor, although he is a little bit one note in this movie. But
disagree.
Jim Broadbent,
I'll take that note all day. Play it again.
In a movie with these great actors, I realized, I don't think that much of Tom Hanks as an actor. I just like, whoa, is this the same guy who did like these movies that I really love and respect? And it got me looking back at Tom Hanks' performances and asking, was that about the rest of the movie and not the acting? Because in this film, compared to these other actors, Tom Hanks was just kind of stinky.
I mean, I can't disagree.
I think Tom Hanks' greatest asset is his ability to generate sympathy from me. Any character he plays, I always get.
Yeah, but in this movie, it's Zachary's the only one that does. Like,
right.
The rest of his characterizations, mm-hmm. I think, are kind of cartoony. Mm-hmm. I think that as the, you know, he's got big buck teeth in the ship one, and he's got the that British gangster thing was ridiculous. I think that he is. When he's at his most Tom Hanks, you're right, he is those things. And where he was in this movie was the Zachary stuff. That's the most Tom Hanks we got. And that I loved, and I think that's why I liked it, is because that was him, and that's what I expect from him.
But it's also the direct comparisons. Like when you flip from seeing Tom Hanks to seeing freaking Hugh Grant in San Francisco in 1973 in that suit.
Mm-hmm. I always had trouble spotting Hugh Grant. It was the one that I had the most trouble spotting.
He was the one who kind of took me out of the film as soon as they showed him in the 2012 Jim Broadbent.
Yes. Yes.
With why like so just, much rubber on his face.
Why didn't they just have Jim Broadbent play his own brother?
I don't know.
They were never really on the screen together.
Yeah.
Why not? Yeah. Like, that was so weird to me because there was a shot of Hugh Grant as Jim Broadbent's old brother bed with his wife, whoever that is. Yeah, and she was also wearing crazy, horrible face makeup.
By the way, that's not a her. That was a dude. That was, hold on.
Yeah, that was the guy. He played, was the guy. No one didn't recognize him. He was Georgette. It's been,
James Darcy,
boy, Robin Frobisher. Yeah. No, it was Ben.
Yeah. No.
He was Georgette. Ben Whishaw was Georgette.
Oh, you're right. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, totally. That was horrible. Yeah. And and it's one of those things where I'm like, you stuck to the plan too hard. There should have been a spot making this movie where they go, oh, you know what? We could just have Jim Broadbent be his own brother, and that will, and then we don't have to put the viewer through this.
Yeah,
apparently,
but I can see that
according to the trivia, Hugh Grant didn't join the cast until 5 days before shooting.
Oh my!
So they might have had that prosthetic plan for somebody else, and it fit them better.
Well, sure. Didn't he? So he was also the leader of the Kona lead, bad guy leader. Shocking. I didn't know that till the credits.
I need to watch the credits, damn it.
The credits are good.
Pause recording. I'm going to go watch the credits.
All right.
I was trying to, there was one actor I was trying to figure out who he was. He was always a lazeabout, and he was always trying to drink soap or was always taking in too much stuff, and he was always taking naps.
Wait a minute. He was always drinking soap, eating soap.
Yeah. During the story, Somni story, he was like the one that was having sex with the other Somni,
that guy
drinking the soap. And he was also one of the tribal people later on who had partied so much at Zachary's hometown, where he was, or home tribe place. he was passed out and he got his.
Well, that's the thing. At the, during the credits, when they show just the principal cast and all the people that they played, right. They then in the regular credits have this cool bracketed credit system where it's like the actor name, and then it branches out to like five people, almost like a
you need a
chart.
Spreadsheet
yeah.
to know really who do. Was who in this movie.
I mean, to Randy's point, yes, you kind of do. Like, yeah. And they create that. They create a flow chart in the credits that sort of says who did what. So there is lots of that. Like Zun Zhou was Talbot, the hotel manager, Yuna 939, and Rose.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't remember who any of those people were.
No, I don't either.
She is such an amazing actress, and it's another one of those I could imagine you not perfectly telling her apart from her co-star.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad. And it's too bad that Duna Bay went on to make Sense8, because that's all I could see every time I saw Duna Bay on screen was, oh, this is the Korean woman from Sense8. And that overruns my ability to really appreciate Zhu Zun's performance.
Well, and again, it's the Wachowskis, right? Sense8 is theirs. So this makes sense. They're continuing. In fact, I got a Sense8 vibe through this whole thing. Like this, this is very much, I feel like Sense8 is almost like them going, you know what? We didn't really do what we wanted. Let's do a TV show and make it like Sense8.
Near the end, if suddenly you had Jim Sturgess, Ben Whishaw, Halle Berry, Jim Broadbent, Duna Bay, and Tom Hanks all having sex in their mind, I would have been like, okay, that's fine. I could accept that.
Yeah. I hated that about that show. There was too much of it. I don't mind sex. I'm not a prude, but man, those people were doing it every 5 seconds.
It was a lot of sex.
Yeah, always. That's if there's anything to remember about that movie or about that TV show before it got canceled was, we're all doing it.
I also kept assuming that from front to back there would be a love story that was from start to end, but there really wasn't a love story
this film
fell all the way through. It kind of fell in between.
You kind of had a little bit of the Tom Hanks Halle Berry.
But love affair didn't start until the 70s, I think, and then ended to the end.
Right.
It's only in two of the six segments.
Exactly.
And that's the thing. Like,
right.
This movie kind of subverts that. It goes out of its way to not show you any much romance. Like there's a couple of moments of it, but it's like Jim Broadbent's characters. I don't know how they came to be. He doesn't have parents who ever had romance. You know what I mean? Like this movie doesn't like that.
Yeah. I tried to also figure out why the story arc was at the beginning and the end, because I know this was all about, change and how things grow over time. But I didn't understand why the story started at the 1800s and ended at 22. I was trying to figure out what exactly needed to be encapsulated in that time period. Was it just because of runtime, or is the story larger than that in the Cloud Atlas book? I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, I don't know.
So I was just, they chose five time periods in a, I wasn't sure exactly what significance that was.
I mean, there may not be any. I don't know, but I
might not be.
I think that for some reason the 70s is always interesting for everyone to always fiddle with. So that seemed all right. 2012 is a weird pick. So I guess there's just modern day because the movie came out in 2012.
At the time, it was released in 2012.
But everything else seemed pretty arbitrary. And then the two future ones, what was it, 22 or 2144? I think was the neo soul period, and then. I guess 300 years after that for the other thing.
Tribalism was very strong in all the stories, except I felt like in the modern present day for 2012, and then it became family tribalism, because there's actually a comment from Broadbent that talks about going to get his brother. And so it was more of a family tribalism. So it was.
I could see that. Yeah. Right. Like it was a little more of a personal.
Right.
A personal thing. But man, they really are all separate movies. And and in some ways, as much as I enjoyed it, surprisingly so much as I enjoyed it, it did make me kind of wonder what they really all in the end didn't have anything to do with each other. I mean, they kind of did, but it was always very forced. Like this narration is obviously referring to this other thing. And then the other thing would happen. And it was like, okay, I see. And so there's some poetry happening, but I'm not sure any of it was like.
So, I was kind of like thinking, kind of like a, mosaic or pointillism when I was watching this. I was thinking, you know, when you really get close, you see one thing, but then when you kind of step back, maybe there'd be a bigger picture for the film. And I don't think there was a bigger picture needed. And so as a consumer of art in film, especially, I was trying to look for things that were usual and normal, and I couldn't find all of those here. And it's an interesting soup.
Yeah.
And
I think if
you enjoyed it, great. I criticize nobody for liking things. Usually the only time I criticize anyone is for hating things. And it's because usually hate leads to destruction. And but you know, if you like something, I'm not going to say nothing.
Well, how does it sound? Who says it in Star Wars? Hate leads to how's it go?
Right. Oh yeah, yeah.
Yoda.
Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
Right. Right.
Shithole. So my home. This is. That's what he says. Anyway.
This movie was missing a lot of internal consistency and continuity, and that also took me out of the film quite a bit. Like the earliest thing in the timeline that we see is the about to become a slave Altua being whipped. Mm-hmm. And it's brutal. It's near murder. And then the next times we see him, I'm expecting huge bleeding wounds on his back. And no, he's fine. There's not even scars. And it's like, okay, all right. So this movie just portraying, I don't know, an incredible amount of time and healing has passed by or something.
Maybe. Right? Tom Hanks and his big accidental machete slice across his face. They were really, you know, they made sure we knew that stuck around, you know, so right, they were a little inconsistent.
Like, there's a scene where a bunch of old folks in a prison old folks home all cause a distraction and they're all fighting and falling over tables and stuff. And I expected Cavendish to have some bumps and bruises, maybe a cut, maybe, you know what I mean? Like he doesn't, they're all fine. It's a perfect, like, this movie just doesn't care about that kind of continuity at all.
Hmm.
Or realism, because I mean, we, you know, there's, once again, this is all about, in my opinion, movie genres, and, you know, like there's some things that happened in the later parts that were like superhero stuff almost. I mean, the Sun Mi stuff during her generation, and those characters were jumping around and shooting each other. It was just totally unrealistic, but fun to watch.
Yeah.
Fun to watch.
Yeah, it was.
So embrace that genre.
I still don't understand why, what's the name, committed suicide in the tub. I'm confused.
He had completed his story because he only had one love. And once he had finished that love, everything else was just going to suffering. And he was ready to.
But he saw him again. Hold on, Abbott, what were you going to say? I heard you.
Oh, I thought it was because he knew that he was kind of doomed from killing.
He was attempting
to kill the composer dude, Jim Broadbent.
And he believed in a reincarnation. He says it when he's talking about killing himself that he'll return.
He'll see him again.
That door will shut and the new door will open.
He'll come back as the wife of freaking...
Right, Georgette.
Yeah.
This is the next time we see him, I believe, is when he's Georgette.
Yeah.
Correct.
I mean, maybe...
I've made a horrible mistake.
Yeah.
Horrible.
I do. I kind of want to read the book because the book obviously does not have this whole everyone looks alike thing going.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because you use your imagination.
I assume it doesn't. The book doesn't go, and now we're in the future, and that guy looks very much like the guy we just talked. I'm sure they don't do that.
No.
So I kind of want to be rid of that just so I can see what's underneath of it a little more.
It would help to separate voices that are spoken and you know, bodies that are seen and faces that are seen. It would help a lot to put that in a book. That was the challenge of this thing, was bringing those elements to a film.
It's ambitious.
Actually, the next time we see Wisha, he's the record shop owner who gives Halle Berry the Cloud Atlas album.
Oh, right.
Wait, that's, oh, wow. So he gave her his, oh, so that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I just looked up the book.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna listen to the audiobook for this. It's got a cast of narrators,
mm-hmm.
and that just always gets me. Like anytime, an audiobook went to the trouble, you know, of how it's got Scott Brick, Cassandra Campbell, Kirby Havone, John Lee. Like that says to me that I'm gonna be able to, you know, to get a lot of different like voices in my head instead of, you know, like if you just read a book, you're the one inventing all the voices.
Interesting. Right. Yeah, maybe I would do audiobook in this case, because I'm feel like I want more. I went to Wikipedia. I started, it's definitely got me in a deep dive mood for it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the book would be the way to do that. But yeah.
I avoided as much theory and explanation on this film as I possibly could. I watched it twice. I watched it once all the way through. Then I watched it a second time, just kind of jumping around, trying to see what I had missed and reframing some of the things. And I tried to avoid any explanations online because this is such a, this film is essentially, since it leaves so much open, there's going to be a lot of personal experience or artistic impression that lingers with everybody. Like Randy really has the slavery part really stood out to him, whereas the slavery part was there for me, but it was more about tribalism for me. And so I tried to avoid theories because I think this was left open-ended enough that each individual should be able to pick their own beliefs of what this movie is.
Yeah, it's a weird thing.
Belief, very important here too.
It's a weird movie. I feel like it was super ambitious and in some ways failed, but I recognize the ambition. By the way, there were a couple of moments like legit anxiety when elevators die. And for some reason, for some reason, 70s elevators that die freaked me out even more. I don't know why.
I felt uncomfortable that I felt like they needed to reveal that Halle Berry had that the star tattoo on her. Yeah, the comment, but I really felt uncomfortable that she was in there with that older man, and then she's like, it's hot in here. As soon as she says it's hot in here, I'm like, oh, crap, she's going to start shedding clothes here. Now. This is going to get uncomfortable. I don't want to see this part. And
dear Penthouse Forum.
Yes.
Right? I was in an elevator with Halle Berry.
I only believe this happened to other people and would never happen to me.
Scott actually said something just a minute ago that was awesome, and it really got my mind buzzing, and that's the phrase, ambitious movie that failed.
Mm.
What's your like all-time ambitious movie that failed? I'll go first.
Yeah.
It's the Hobbit trilogy.
Yeah.
That is like, I want to like it. You know, I want to appreciate all of the effort. You know, like how do you end up with 7 hours of movie without making a lot of effort, right?
Yeah.
Did not need a trilogy. I was so disappointed when I found out it was a trilogy. I really felt like they could have done it in one.
Well, they were milking it. They knew they were milking it. And I don't know why Peter Jackson magic wasn't there for this one. Like, it's just, that's a weird animal. The Hobbit is a great pick. I'm going to say another movie that I actually really enjoy, but I know it's not good. And we've done it on FilmSack. It's Waterworld. I feel that way about Waterworld.
Ambitious
super, as like, hell, like, yeah. But just they didn't exactly hit the mark. They hit enough marks for me to watch it every year, but they but I'm not going to argue for its quality. I know it's got its problems, but I think that's a good example. But do you have one that you
I'll throw out Bonfire of the Vanities. Such a attempt to have this All-star. Big cast. Tom Hanks,
yeah,
Bruce Willis, Tom Hanks again, mm-hmm. Bruce Willis. I want to say Julia Roberts was in that.
I'm
trying to remember everybody that was in it, but it was like this, like, let's get every A-lister we can into this adaptation of a Tom Wolfe book. And apparently just, you know, failed at every level. I saw it in the theaters and cool.
That thing farted, man. That was a big fart, that movie.
Yeah, it was a really big fart.
Yeah. Brian De Palma directed that even?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, Brian like you got the one of the greatest like directors of all time. Sounded
like it would be good.
Yeah.
Good source material, good actors, good director, and just too many rights made a wrong, basically. Yeah.
Good call on that one. Good call on that one.
Dunaway, do you know of a really ambitious movie that just
Know of a really ambitious movie, but it didn't necessarily fail for everybody, but it failed for the most important part for me. The most important part of any movie for me is definitely the story, because to me, that's what film is all about. It doesn't have to be, you may not view it the same way. However, I will say Avatar was super ambitious and super successful.
I was guessing you were going to say that because I've known you for a long time now. Whenever I think of you in movies, you want a movie to have this heart, and Avatar has a Jarvis heart. It's got a, you know, it's got a
true story. Yeah.
It's got a heart made of plastic, and it's beating, and it's doing its job, but it's not like
beautiful. It is a beautiful movie, and the things it did for 3D, which Scott hates, was amazing. And James Cameron just made a most enjoyable popcorn eaten flick that was just amazing. But oh man,
it's the second highest grossing film of all time now.
Yeah, yeah.
Only recently enthroned.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll see, because don't forget, Avatars 2 and 3 is coming out. They may re-release the Avatar back to the theater just to see if they can tell those, you know, Avengers to suck it.
Yeah. I don't know. Does that feel like something James Cameron would do? Like,
absolutely.
Do you think that would count, though? You can always keep the numbers separately.
That's what the Avengers did. They said, coming back out to theaters.
Yeah, but they were still in the theaters when they did it. They weren't out yet. So they
only at the dollar theaters. That don't count.
No, they were still like straight up. You could go anywhere to see Avengers. They just swapped it out.
Everything I've seen, they always count the later stuff. Even like E.T. keeps on ticking up because every once in a while they re-release it at the theater. So I think Star Wars did that too.
You know, it came out in 77, had its huge run, disappeared for a couple months, and then they brought it back for another showing. And that's not even the special edition one that, you know, came back several years later.
97 or whenever that was. Was that 90s? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would have been 90s.
Yeah, would have been 90s.
That's fascinating. All right. What else? Yes.
I just want to follow on that last subject. And the question is, how do you make a movie like Waterworld really great? Like, how do you make it something that everyone looks back on and thinks of as an Oscar winner? And like a movie that people are proud of, you know, having been a critic about and this kind of thing.
I have the answer. You give it to George Miller and you tell him to write it and direct it. That's what
you're saying. Just change everything is what you're saying.
I don't know. Like conceptually that movie, what it was trying to be was really truly just water based Mad Max future. And in a lot of ways it succeeds at that, which is why I think I'm okay with it as how it is now. I think that it was a different time, though. That we're talking about the peak of Costner's career, and he was in a very cocky place and was not taking anything from anyone, like was really hard to work with and all that other stuff. And I think that that plays a role in all of this. Like sometimes when something bad is being made, you're just too close to it to notice until it's out. And then you're like, oh, my gosh, what did we do?
Can I throw an unpopular opinion out there that Scott, you might want to cover your ears for?
Oh, shit. Go.
Is it if they put somebody besides Kevin Costner in the lead, who I love Kevin Costner,
but
he delivered such a subdued.
Yeah. He's such a dead fish, right? That's exactly what you mean. Dead fish.
Just in that film. I love Kevin Costner, but maybe somebody a little bit more.
I think the answer is yes. I mean, I don't think that's sacrilege in this case, even though I think that he is good for it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that maybe
somebody could have been better. What if Keanu Reeves had been in that? That would have been like that Waterworld.
Maybe, so I don't know.
I love Keanu Reeves too, but I don't think he's as good as everybody thinks he is.
We're just having a moment with him.
He's very good at what he does, yes.
He's good at it being himself, and that is fantastic. Yeah. I'll always go see a film with him in it.
But
I also don't think it would be like you wouldn't want a Bruce Willis or a Sylvester Stallone or anybody else, let's
be honest, in a world without John Wick, nobody gives a shit right now about Keanu Reeves. Mm-hmm. Like Keanu Reeves is having a moment because he's in a series that now is beloved and is one of the great modern action franchises.
Keanu Reeves shows that you can come back from being sad Keanu Reeves on a picnic bench eating a sandwich.
Yep, you can.
That was like 10 years ago. It blows my mind.
What was
it? Sad Keanu. Oh, his meme Keanu moment was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And that Keanu is 54 right now. How is this possible?
He's got the good genes, man. He's got the good genes. Who could be the Mariner today? I don't know. Like almost everything, I would prefer Waterworld to be a Netflix series. Or something. Like, I would like to drag it out. I'd like to have more exposition, more character, more long story with my genre in general. Right. I'm starting more and more these days, as much as this seems counter to FilmSack, more and more these days, I like my genre to be in, you know, consumable, smaller chunks. It's weird.
And, you know, and you say that, and then Netflix puts out a stinker like Another Life, and yeah, I can't.
That's too bad.
I can't help but wish for something completely different, right?
Like, is it bad? Oh, I haven't seen it yet.
I'm one episode in. Should I stop?
Is it not good? That bums me out.
I can't recommend it. No. And it's like, and it's at 6% on Rotten Tomatoes or something. Yeah. It's like,
bums me out.
It's so unfortunate. But when you look at something like Another Life, you can't help but think, oh, there's a kernel of something great here. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't it have been just made by other people, starring other people, you know?
Mm-hmm. That bums me out, though. I hadn't heard that it was bad yet. Now I know.
I don't know whether to stop watching or...
Well, I mean, if you enjoy
it... You've already started now. Rip the Band-Aid.
Yeah, you've already started. You just have to commit another 10 hours.
I know, that's exactly right. 6%
rating.
Did you enjoy what you've seen?
So far I'm liking it. Yeah, but again, they've set up the story in episode 1 and I like where that's headed.
Mm-hmm.
But if I find out they don't stick the landing, I'm really bummed and I don't want to waste my time on the rest of it.
Yeah, I would hope that I hear about those things coming out and I get super excited. I know they can't all be good, but
sure.
You know, once in a while, something like here's what seems like the exception that proves the rule. But I recommended this last week on TMS and I'll say it again here. Tarantino put together a director's cut and also broken up into pieces to create a mini series for Hateful Eight and put it on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And it's now in like, I think it's 5 episodes, 4 episodes, whatever it is. It's awesome in that format. It's really, really great. It's already kind of an overlong film as it was standalone. But for some reason, done like this in these sort of vignetted chunks, it really does it for me. I would highly recommend, if you've never seen it, first of all, to watch this version. And also, if you have seen it, revisit it again. And I think you'll come away being reminded that Hateful Eight might be my favorite Tarantino movie. And I think it is... partly because of this the way that they formatted it. So I'm just kind of into this in general. I wish more creatives would just come to a series. It doesn't have to be Netflix. I don't care who it is, but you know, go to HBO. HBO seems like a good place for Cloud Atlas to get all spread out, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Something about the movie itself felt HBO ish to me. Can't, and it's not just the naked lady on top of the dude. It's something else. some kind of vibe I was getting. It was very HBO. Sure. Anyway, anybody got anything else to say here? I mean, the only trivia I've got really is, but they had a budget of over $100 million. Cloud Atlas is considered an independent film, though. It's not a big studio film.
It's odd.
Paid for a lot by the directors and makers and writers. So it makes it one of, if not the most expensive, independent films ever made.
Right, which is good because as a producer, someone who is putting money into a film, this film takes a lot of artistic risk. Not something you want to do if you're investing into a film that you want to make the most amount of money possible.
Yeah.
So I guess that's probably the reason why they kind of went independent. It was a passion project, if you will.
I would agree.
With a lot of money behind it.
Also, Tom Hanks claims this is one of the few films that he's in that he likes to rewatch. I don't know if that's true, but he claims he likes to rewatch this one.
Yeah.
So there's
he said something like it's the only one of his movies that he's seen more than twice.
Yeah.
Right.
Which just
I'm still trying to understand it.
I don't get it. What was I even doing there?
How the hell have I seen Forrest Gump so much more than Tom Hanks?
I don't blame him.
I know. I feel like I have too. It's a weird thing to find out about the guy, but assuming it's true, who knows? It's IMDb.
Yeah.
All right, clips time. We got clips today, and we'll start with Keith David, because why not? Here's that scene we were talking about. He's working as an indentured servant to Hugh Grant, and here it is.
You enjoy your life here with us, do you not?
Oh, yes, Reverend, sir. Kupak are very happy here.
Very happy.
Oh, God, we haven't talked about... English actors trying to do American accents. Oh, God.
Oh, did that happen? Okay, so I have a question about that. Did Hugh Grant in the 70s, was he supposed to be doing, was it supposed to be sort of British or American or what was that supposed to be?
Everything that happens in the Americas They're supposed to be Americans. They're English actors playing Americans.
Oh,
Hugh
I didn't
Grant
know that.
Is playing an American. Hugo Weaving is playing an American. And they're so bad at it. Like, that was actually the beginning of me just writing over and over, I wish there was more cast. I wish they had just cast other people to play these other roles.
That's hilarious. I thought that they were just sort of kind of British. Or, I guess in Hugo Weaving's case, sort of Australian. In the modern, in the 70s one. And I just wasn't sure, because if Hugh Grant was trying to do American, that was really bad. Like, dude, you are bad. Most of your cohorts over there in Britain are pretty good at this. You're bad at it.
And again, it's also a problem of time. Like, we recently saw Chernobyl, and they just let the actors use their natural accents. They should do that.
I love that. That worked so well to me. Oh, man, Chernobyl's good. If you guys haven't watched that, go watch that.
I need Chernobyl Part 2. I just heard they're having some problems over there in Russia, so maybe we'll get to see a Part 2.
We're going to get a Part 2. This is all a plot by HBO.
Yeah, they had
To advertise another podcast, there is a new This Week episode of the Chernobyl podcast, which you would think, how could that be? But there was a huge nuclear explosion in Russia last week, and Peter Sagal and Craig Mazin, who made Chernobyl, got together with Jared Harris, the actor from Chernobyl, and just talked about Chernobyl some more and talked about this recent development. And man, I like it makes me want every TV series to have a podcast.
Mm-hmm. You know? No, that podcast was so good as a companion for that show. I could not recommend that enough. People, if you're listening and you're like, I don't know, I never got around to watching it, watch that show, and after every episode, listen to the podcast they made for that episode. It is a great pairing, and that dude's brilliant, and he should win every award he's up for, because it's really good. Mm-hmm. And I still can't get Naked Miner out of my head. I just can't do it. Walking around with his wiener going, yeah, this is what we do. We're too hot. We got to go down with our wieners. Hard to get out of your head. All right, here's some awkward singing. Here you go.
Did you loop that?
No. No.
It seemed a lot longer.
I took out some of the in-betweens.
Did you un-auto-tune that?
I took out some stuff in the middle where he, like he said, no, write that part down, and then he would keep singing. I took some of that out.
Right. I'd love to hear that auto-tuned. Auto-tune that for me.
There's another thing I hated about the movie. I've been playing the piano since I was 4. Uh-huh. This guy is a great composer and can't sing to save his life? No.
He struggled. He struggled.
No. No, I mean, just because you're a composer doesn't mean you're a good singer.
It absolutely should have been him singing something that was more understandable. Absolutely. Like, this idea that this kid sitting at the piano could have any idea what to write down on the music notation is just ridiculous. Like, it was insane. And it's like no one making the film had any idea about composing music at all. And it's fine. Like, you go on and the story is okay. It's just that moment made me freaking mad. It was like, it reminded me of again, my brother, the air traffic controller, watching the movie Pushing 10. He was mad, angry at this thing.
That does happen. Yeah, I get that way with computer stuff in movies. I get it. Like, the more people know about medicine, the less they can watch ER or, you know, some stupid hospital drama.
Also,
it's the same thing.
Why the hell can't great legendary composer write down his own stuff? Give me a break. That he can't transcribe what's in his head.
He's old and has crazy hair. Crazy. Yeah. All right, here is, what? That's Tom Hanks. I don't know what he says here.
I don't give a f*** what happens when I'm dead. I want people to buy me book now.
Buy me book now.
Buy me book now, governor.
Hey. Stop looking at those cauliflower ears. Rib. I guess he got beaten up so many times in the boxing.
So bad. Gosh dang it, that was bad. I hated that bit. All right.
Where's our money?
Shit. Sorry, that guy wasn't supposed to talk yet. All right, here's I put end this scene. Well, anyway, here.
Just what does that leadless pencil you call an imagination have in mind to end this scene?
Oh, yeah, that guy's good. His voice, dude. Mm. And he's the creepy bald dude interrogating later, right? Same dude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep.
He's got some range.
Darcy.
got some range. Okay, then this guy again.
Where's our money?
Now, actually, he said, where's our effing money? But it was easier to do that than
that's pretty good.
Yeah. So where's our money? All right, here's a... What? Here.
Boys. Boys, look here.
Oh.
Boys.
When they had him trapped in there. By the way, gross the scene is just the thought of having somebody push a used toilet plunger in your face. That's gross. Oh. That's a gross me out.
Yeah.
Can't deal with that. All the violence, guy falling out of off the roof, splattering all over the car. None of that bugged me. It was the toilet plunger. Broadbent. Oh, here he is with the plunger in his face.
That did gross you out, right,
Scott? Yeah, totally gross me out.
Okie dokie.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It was disgusting. Okay, video. Oh, this is pretty good.
Get them to video it for us, would you? Now, fuck off.
I kind of like. I mean, I know he had a lot of rubber on, and Randy makes a good point about didn't really feel like Broadbent's brother, but I kind of like the portrayal of that cranky brother. If I'm honest, I mean,
yeah, the acting's fine. It was just the prosthetics were distracting. It pulled me out.
Yeah, I could see that. Never pull out. Wait, what?
I just want to say to my brother, brother Travis, Travis, if you're listening, I will not imprison you later.
Oh,
we'll see.
That was a bizarre thing.
Very weird. The movie likes to say the name of the movie, so I captured it a couple times. Here's one of them.
This is the Cloud Atlas Sextet.
Yes, that's the Cloud Atlas Sextet.
Sextet.
Here's a funny line from Broadbent.
To the Temple of Sacrifice, where I offered up my virginity.
Now, that's great, except then he said...
Pussy.
All right, great.
I was hoping you were going to capture that. Official description.
Official, what was it? What
did, cause of, official yeah. cause of...
Not death, what was it? Cause of injury or whatever? Yeah.
Pussy.
Because he had a cat chat people at home. Yeah, he had a cat in his crotch.
Totally fine.
While he was sleeping with Georgette.
Yeah. Played by Susan Sarandon, turns out. We haven't talked about her much. I don't think she was that great. I think she kind of just showed up in bits and was there.
Well, she really played a secondary character anyway. I thought she did fine, especially I thought it was very visually impactful when she was looking into the sky and blinking her eyes and flipping between the eye colors. That was a pretty cool scene.
Yeah, it was
that
right.
was cool. Yeah, a little fortune teller kind of lady thing there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And she said, by the way, Tom Hanks' character, Zachary, she said, don't cut the throat.
Yeah.
Don't, but he did anyway.
He did anyway. Sleeping. Oh, no, that wasn't Hugh Grant. Hugh Grant.
That wasn't him, which is, I went back. I looked at that picture that Ibbitt sent us, and I didn't realize. Actually, I had said that I didn't know who was in Neo Soul's character in the, the Papa Soul restaurant. That was actually Hugh Grant. I didn't realize that he was the bad guy drinking the soap.
Okay. I didn't know that was him either. Okay, cool. What a weird movie.
By the way, for listeners, do a search for Scene Stealers Cloud Atlas infographic, and it's a really cool
thing
that talks about each of the six storylines, which character each of the actors play, and how actually even more than I thought their roles were similar. Hugh Grant is always the ruthless leader, and Hugo Weaving is always evil incarnate, and Tom Hanks is the everyman chooser.
Well, everyman chooser.
Everyman chooser. Except I don't know how he's the everyman chooser when he's the gangster.
Yeah, I don't get that part.
Not very everyman.
Well, you're right. Well, they said there was a lot of people that supported him when he threw it off. It's like everybody was so excited about him throwing the guy off.
Oh, okay.
But why? Yeah, he committed murder.
And so he's an author in that case who goes to prison. And then the publisher gets all the money, right? Like, that's cool, I guess. They could have actually depicted that little bridge part in that sequence.
They probably could have done it a little better. All right, do not... Oh, this here he is. Here's Hugo Weaving as a lady.
I am Miss Noakes. You do not wish to cross me.
He makes the most disturbing...
Does.
Nurse Lee.
You're just
Hugo Weaving. Seriously, seriously, where's his range?
Does he have range?
I loved old George. I thought that was I thought that's pretty good.
Yeah, that was really good. But as far as like his range, I mean, I don't know if he has much, but you do kind of get Hugo Weaving and everything. Like it's always the same kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think I'm okay with that.
Yeah,
I think I'm totally fine with that.
Same. I think it's fine. You ever see Priscilla, Queen of the Desert? You guys ever see that?
His other cross-dressing.
Yeah. He was very good in that, you know.
He was.
He's all right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything you need? Oh, it was Keith David.
Anything you need, sir, just let me know.
See, it may as well be. And then the President Jefferson that weekend died. And President, it just sounds like he's narrating something to me. Mm-hmm. Here's I don't know what this is.
Even if he shits silver nuggets.
And that was that guy again who played the bald interrogator. He had the most range. Yeah. Huge range, that guy.
Play it again. Out of context, it's so good.
Even if he shits silver nuggets.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Shit silver nuggets.
I like all the pirate stuff. Or they were sort of piratey. I guess they weren't pirates. They were merchants. Yeah. Anyway, here's something that's creepy. So here's that.
There's a natural order to this world, Fabricant. And the truth is, this order must be protected.
May as well be Agent Smith at that point.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's just Hugo Weaving again and again.
I smell your sweat. All right, here's some nonsense.
You really ain't fear about meeting old Geordie on a summit?
What?
Exactly, huh?
Yeah. Didn't understand that at all. In fact, let's try it again.
You really ain't fear about meeting old Geordie on a summit?
You really ain't feared about me.
Fear about... Eating,
knowing
eating
he knows Geordi.
Geordi
from Star Trek.
Oh, he's going to eat Geordi on a Sunday.
On a summit.
On a summit.
Old Geordi. That's summit. He's saying old Geordi on the summit.
Oh, we okay. We've done it now. We've cleared
it. Wow. That took. See, if you were watching the film in the theater and you caught that, you'd be sitting around going, okay, what he's
saying? Yeah, it's impossible.
You missed the next scene.
Yeah, you're not wrong. It's really, really hard to hear that. All right, here's them saying the name again.
I call it the Cloud Atlas Sextet.
All right, thank you for that.
Sextet.
That guy's. Oh, you guys, if you haven't seen the Mary Poppins thing, he's delightful in that. It's really good. Ibbot, I got one from your mom.
Oh, good.
Yep.
Hello. Let's phrase that a little bit differently.
Yeah. This is
got one.
Another
got one from your mom.
some more audio from high school, I guess. You would have been probably prom age. And I think this was after you took the girl home and you kissed her in her foyer and then left, her foyer. Four year. And this is what you said after.
The room stank of bitter medicine.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. To...
Well, that's because she took some NyQuil to go to bed, right?
Is that it?
trying to... Get that ever mind.
Hey, when did they start making NyQuil that just puts you to sleep? I'd never heard that. Right. That's
it's
new
called
to me.
Z-Quil now, yeah, right? Z-Quil. Yeah,
that's crazy.
They started making it. They started marketing it like about maybe 4 or 5 years ago here. Anyway,
did not know that was a thing. Until
I thought it
was. Recently.
I thought it always put you to sleep. No,
it is does. That-
well, no, no,
it does.
Now they sell it as Z-Quil. So that is a marketing
like
difference.
Knockout.
Same stuff.
Boink.
It's not the same stuff though. They only include the alcohol. And something else, but the acetaminophen's not in there. So they're not putting painkillers
or
stuff that drops your fever or any of that. It's just the sleepy bit.
Sleepy bits.
Yeah, sleepy bits. All right, here's a funny line I thought.
Don't need no smart rope.
Don't need no smart rope. Don't you
apparently
give me
you
no
do
smart rope.
Because you're going to cut your hands all up.
Yeah. You sure? Oh, boy, did he. That was hard to watch.
That was hard to watch.
And finally, this is some weird line that I think Halle Berry said.
You Judas in your kin for a piece of ass.
Oh, yeah, there was that part. Sorry, it was Georgie and his weird, Georgie. Creepy lead up. I mean, this, you know, turn your headphones up at home and listen to this again.
You Judas in your kin for a piece of ass.
That's scary, dude.
I want to watch that whole movie. I want to see Tom Hanks dealing with old Georgie. I'd like to see just a standalone of that. Matter of fact, I was curious. I was like looking around. I'm like, surely someone has recut this Cloud Atlas so that, you know, just back to back, you know, just these scenes from just this story.
And yeah, this, right. Sure. I mean, somebody did that with Pulp Fiction and
right. Surely someone's really done well. That.
Yeah.
I can't find it.
I would.
I kind of want old Georgie in Castaway now.
Oh,
that'd be, yeah. That'd be Wilson. Great. Yeah, instead of Wilson, Georgie! Yeah.
Go up to the top of the mountain, put that noose around your neck.
Yeah.
If you're trying to take out that rotten tooth, might I recommend a skate?
What was up with the theme of the teeth? What was that?
Oh, yeah, the teeth and the beer. Yeah. And yeah.
The teeth at the beginning of the story when he's like, the cannibals used to eat and spit the teeth out like cherry stems.
Yeah.
And then I was curious about the teeth thing, but I did not even think about that
as a theme. Huh.
You're right. It was thematic. You're not wrong. There were teeth throughout.
What do the teeth mean? What do they represent, yeah, Brian Dunaway?
What do they mean? What does it mean? It's like rain?
I gotta know.
It's like the rain.
Symbolism.
Oh, no.
Symbolism.
What are you going to do? Sounds like it's a film tech checklist time. Amazing actors, hard to follow story. Check. Cloud Sense 8 Atlas. Check. Oval displays are lame. Check. I think those
that was weird tech.
Mm.
It was good for privacy screens, but it was a weird tech.
Yeah, yeah, the fact that from the back side they were transparent, but from the front side you were seeing an image was kind of cool. It's like, all right, but like waving them off and they just disappear. I want a little nanite, right? That just goes in my pocket in a little recharging thing like my AirPods.
So you had no trouble with Tom Cruise swiping stuff off that window like a crazy man in Minority
Report. None whatsoever. Because he had a little. Because he had a little thing on his head that helped manage all that stuff. And gloves, fancy gloves.
Right. You're right. Fancy gloves and a headband thing.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Brian's wrong. Never. Continually wrong about it, maybe. Star Trek Connection, we have one. Susan Sarandon is married to Chris Sarandon, who was in DS9 as Martus Mazur in the episode Rivals.
A loose connection.
That's all there is, which really surprised me. I could have sworn Broadbent had done something, but no. He has not been in Star Trek. He deserves to be, though. He'd be great on there.
Yeah.
But yeah, nobody.
He was also Prince Humperdinck in The Princess Bride, Chris Sarandon.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Susan Sarandon's, yeah.
Oh, so wait a minute. Is she still? I thought she was married
She was married to Tim Robbins for a while, but I think Chris Sarandon must have been her first husband.
Okay. I'm thinking of
Or brother?
Yeah, I'm thinking she
or
was.
Both?
I thought she was still married to. I thought she was still married to Andy Dufresne. I was sure of that, but maybe not.
I don't think so. No, they. I think things aren't very good.
They climb through
between
shit.
Them now. Yeah,
they climb through shit
I'm
and came
to
out
see what
dirty.
What the connection is? Yeah. Let's see, Susan.
Maybe he threw a rock at her.
He
went
married
right through
classmate
her.
Susan Tomlin in 1967. After they graduated, they both pursued acting careers. Tomlin took his surname as a professional name, Susan Sarandon. They divorced in 1979.
Oh, geez.
Give me back my surname.
That was like back in, what was the thing where you throw hot dogs and water bottles and stuff? What's that movie?
That was your high school life. That was nothing anybody else did, Scott.
No, that's a thing.
Oh, Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That would have been that for him.
A movie.
Hot dogs and water bottles.
Yeah, don't you go to the theater and everyone has water bottles and hot dogs?
They have spray bottles so that you can spray rain, and everybody puts a newspaper over the head. And I don't know about the hot dog, but you throw toast when Riff Raff says he wants to propose a toast.
I could have sworn that I went to one of those in high school where we threw hot dogs at the screen.
I knew it was high school. I knew it. Called it.
Yeah.
That was just a local Utah thing.
Uh-huh. You're thinking of Pee Wee's Dream.
Standing at the top.
Get hot dog water for everybody.
Yeah.
If you got your hot dog water, drink it.
Paging. The natives are all throwing pickles and hot dogs at me. What does it mean?
Paging Mr. Herbert.
Oh my gosh.
All right, let's see. Yeah, that's all you get there. Soundtrack grade, I give it a PG for pretty good. I thought it worked well. Nice and crescendo-y.
Pretty good.
It was nice. I don't know who did it, but it was cool. I don't think the song that they were all singing all the time and humming and then writing and all that was all
not
that great.
Memorable.
Yeah.
No.
They're all acting like it was like, what's that like? It's like the freaking Cones game in Star Trek Next Generation. It's like, oh, we can't stop. It's like, why? It sounds like shit. It's no big deal.
I'm compelled to sing this melody that nobody's ever going to remember.
It was dumb. Oh. Sorry, I forgot the Twitter post. Twitter post, 280 characters or less. Let's sum the damn thing up. Randy?
Cloud Atlas. 3 hours of people struggling with each other, and sometimes a guy feels romantic on a piano bench and starts to go for it, or maybe he's seen a woman's bottom peeking out of her short shorts, and he just has to grab it like a Saturday night at Ibbitt's house.
Yeah. I felt it coming, but I wasn't sure. When
I wasn't prepared. I wasn't prepared.
You weren't ready for that? Oh man.
No, I wasn't. I should always be ready for it.
Be prepared for the night at Ebbett's house that is the most famous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Brian Dunaway.
Cloud Atlas, like being slowly poisoned by a toothy Tom Hanks. Will the suffering never end? Yay, it's over. Let's watch it again.
Yeah.
That's very accurate.
That's kind of where I'm at with it. I kind of feel like it. And I'm not going to do it right away. It's too long, but I kind of want to. I want to read the book.
That's the reason why I just watched it. My second viewing, like I said, was just cherry picking. Just, oh, look at that scene. Oh, when I go through this scene.
I assume the book's huge, right? Is that a fair assumption?
Huge.
It's gigantic.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's probably gigantic.
Let's see. Cloud Atlas book pages.
It's probably a lot.
You should stream it, and then it would be in the cloud.
Yeah, see? Cloud. And then I can.
I don't know, but it's $12.99. That's all I know.
Well, you've really.
Page count, 544.
That's not that bad.
All right. That's all right.
Yeah, that's not
a decent sized book, but. Randy, you'll
shorter
have to,
than it.
Randy, if you end up watching it or listening to it, you'll have to tell us how that experience goes.
Yeah, it looks like it's 20 hours audiobook version, which is not bad. Nothing like The Wastelands. Do you remember in the early 90s when everybody had a copy of The Wastelands by Stephen King?
Yeah.
They looked like they were carrying around a phone book.
Wait, The Wastelands? Are you talking about, you're not talking about The Stand? Is that what you mean?
The Stand.
The Stand is huge.
No. Tower? So, what?
Huge.
What?
Oh, Dark Tower is huge.
Wait, what's
whenever
the
Wastelands came out, everybody had a copy of it.
I don't know.
It's the third book in
Dark Tower. Oh, right. The Dark Tower third book. You're right. And yep.
Everybody that I knew was carrying around it.
Yeah. It was everywhere, and that was thick as hell.
Oh, yes. Over a thousand pages.
Yeah.
Love it.
And The Stand is a fatty. I've read that five times, though, like an insane person. Oh, I love that book so much. That is an example of something that should be made into a series, and they're doing it. They're making a new one. They're making a new series. Mm-hmm. I can't freaking wait. I can't remember who's doing it. It's like Prime or somebody, but man, oh.
I'm down.
Love that story. All right. Brian Ibbett.
There we go. Cloud Atlas. This is what happens when you play Hulu on shuffle.
Nice.
Yeah, that's really good.
What am I watching now? Oh. A drama, no, a farce.
I like that. That's really good. All right. Well, that now really bleeds. Anyway, it takes us to this. Can't say words. We had alternate titles. This was almost called Forrest Grump because he was so grumpy in the forest there. Or Four Weird Stories and a Couple Funerals.
No.
Oh, the Hugh Grant connection.
See, there you go. Right. Thank you very much.
How about Forrest Chump?
Forrest Chump's not bad.
Maybe.
Forrest
Stump? Oh, Forrest Dump. In case you got to go. Let's get off of it.
Yeah, let's get off of that. Let's move on. Email, real quick. Edward Mooney wrote in. He sent an email to filmsack@gmail.com, and he says this about old FilmSack episodes. Hi, guys. Writing from Alaska. First of all, I'm a huge fan. My friends and I have been listening to FilmSack since the beginning. Keep up the great work. I am writing in to ask if there is a way I can get all the previous episodes. I recently got a new iPhone, and when I attempt to sync with my cloud account, I lost all previous episodes that I had downloaded and saved. I have literally never had this issue before, and I'm very bummed. I listen to FilmSack every day during my hour and a half commute to work and back. Wow, that means a lot of repeats. Any help would be appreciated. Thank you. Yes, in fact, I'm glad you wrote in, and I used your email for this very purpose to announce this. It's been happening for a while, but if you go to the website, filmsack.com, and you look under the little audio section, there's all the usual things like here's the iTunes subscription and here's the whatever, RSS feeds and all that. In there, you'll notice something called the archive RSS feed. That, my friends, is anything 200, let's see, how many we go here? I think it's 150 episodes are on the main feed, and then after that, they go on this archive feed where you can find all the way back to the beginning. So they're all there. All you have to do is just copy and paste that RSS feed into whatever player you're using. They all support it.
It's called the older episodes of FilmSack? Is that what it's called?
Yes, older episodes of FilmSack or archive or something. I forget the exact words.
Right. Got it.
But you won't miss it. It's right there on filmsack.com in the top stuff there. And that way you get everything.
331 and prior.
Yeah.
And 331 was Firefox.
And the reason I do that is because the RSS feeds get so big, they become both technically unwieldy and cause people problems who are trying to ping them, but also it just kills bandwidth. Just as they get to be, you know, 2 megabyte files and 20,000 people hit it, and before you know it, you're paying out of your butthole for more hosting than you'd planned.
Hold on a second. Got to get back here and get my money.
My money is in my butthole. So anyway, that's why. And also, good news is you can get them all the way back to Krull. So worry not, cool. Dear listeners. And that includes you, Edward Mooney. So go check that out. Our next film will be Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer.
That's right. Now, Randy, remind me, this is the movie about a, you go to the mall, the girl freezes your nose and then pierces it.
No, it is not.
Okay.
This is the movie about... Tom Hanks is living in the North Pole, and he has a train.
Great. Piercing the snow with his train.
What's that movie called?
The Polar Express.
Polar Express?
Ah, yeah. That's no. Not Snowpiercer. Snowpiercer is a different movie. Mm-hmm. It's about the Hogwarts Express during the winter.
Oh, good. More Harry Potter then.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. Actually, I'm very much looking forward to this. I like Snowpiercer a great deal. Mm-hmm. Ibbitt was saying he likes the movie, but not the comic so much. So we may talk about that.
I did not like the comic so much.
They draw them trains real poorly in the comic, I hear.
I think the comic just knew how to, or sorry, the movie knew how to lean into what makes that stuff awesome.
I plus probably it's a pretty dark subject, and if you don't play it just right, Chris Evans, it'll seem a little too dark, probably.
Maybe. I mean, he did a good job. It was the first thing I'd seen of him when he wasn't being Captain America over the last, you know, few years, and so
right.
It was fun to see him being something else, but. My memory of that movie is that it's rad and they eat bricks of gelatinized protein, which is kind of cool.
Right.
Which
one of the cargoes are you in, Scott? Are you near the front
of
the train or are you in the car further to the back?
I'm with, what's his name, who died recently? John, not Huntsman, John Hurt. I'm John Hurt. Right. I just draw and paint.
Oh, there you go.
You're in the painting car. Yeah. In the painting car. I thought maybe you were in the caboose, but okay.
I'm clearly just in the dining car. That's right. Why I'm hanging out. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the only car I'm in.
His nine drink minimum.
Is it lunch yet?
Yeah. Brian's hogging all the meatloaf or whatever you would have on such a place. Actually, you're hogging all the bricks of protein.
That's right.
Are you going to eat your protein bar?
Finish your tool to sweat in there?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. That's a really cool movie, though, I think. We'll see if it holds up. It's not that old, so it's not like we're looking at something that's super ancient. It should hold up, and we'll be doing that next week right here on Film Sack. And sorry to let everybody know that Poltergeist has left streaming once again. So yeah,
apparently buried it in an Indian burial ground, and we won't see it for at least 10 years.
Yep. My hope and dream is that maybe around Halloween that thing will crop up again. That would be awesome. But don't hold your breath, everybody.
Only like 90 more days or less till Halloween.
I know, right? That's crazy. I'm excited. Get your scary movie on, everybody. That's coming up soon. But next week it's Snowpiercer. That's going to do it for the show. We are at filmsack.com. You can find everything you need there, including those archive episodes. So do that. You can leave us voicemails at 801-471-0462. And you can email us, filmsack@gmail.com. We're also on Twitter, @filmsack. And you can find the rest of us on Twitter on the site as well. Leave us reviews wherever you get your shows. That's going to do it. For me, for Brian, and for Randy.
Sextet.
See you next time.
Sextet. I was really hoping for.
We'll see.
Should we capture?
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.
Pussy.